Okay, good afternoon. I'd like to start by thanking the organizers for inviting me to this conference, and also earlier for the three-week visit, which was very helpful in understanding some of the experimental issues in this field. What I will do today is to... is the pointer? Is that? Like a pencil. Okay, so what I want to do today is to talk about fermions and bosons in optical lattices, and I will be modeling them as Hubbard models, which will then be simulated using a variety of quantum Monte Carlo techniques. So these Hubbard models are sort of like the Ising models for these interacting situations. Now, I will use a variety of different Monte Carlo methods depending on the kind of problem at hand. I will show you results for bosons at zero and finite temperatures. These are done in collaboration with Yasuyuki Kato and Naoki Kawashima at ISSP Japan using a whirl line algorithm. Then I will talk about a second problem, which is on fermions with attractive interactions with equal Fermi populations. This is mainly addressing properties at finite temperatures done using determinantal quantum Monte Carlo with these collaborators. Brian Peters is an undergraduate, and Mohit Randeria is at OSU, Richard Scalatar at UC Davis. And then I'll turn to the third problem. All of this I'll try to do in 30 minutes, in which I'll talk about repulsive fermions using... these RVB wave functions at zero temperature using variational Monte Carlo. I will touch on some earlier work that we did with Arun Paramkanti, who is now at University of Toronto, and then also more recent work with Sandeep Pathak and Vijay Shenoy at ISC Bangalore. Okay, so the broad picture is something like this. We have a very beautiful tool, these optical lattices, in which one can get into a strongly correlated regime by essentially tuning the well depth. And in terms of these Hubbard models, it basically tunes the tunneling rate between one well to another. I'm going to stay in a regime where U is much larger than the band gap between the different bands, so I can stick with a one-band Hubbard model. Also, for purposes of the talk today, I'm not going to put a trap. But that can be done later in some of these simulations. So now, in increasing degree of complexity, we have the three models. The Bose-Hubbard model, basically a mean field theory can give us the phases quite accurately. We have a superfluid phase and a Mott phase in which the density is fixed at 1. And here, quantum Monte Carlo can be used to get quantitative insights into some of the issues. In the attractive U-Hubbard model, which is somewhat more complicated, it's a fermion model, we can again get quite a bit of idea about the phases from mean field theory. Essentially, you can see because there's attraction, the fermions like to form pairs, and when the hopping is not, or the tunneling is not very strong, you get this kind of a charge density wave solid. And then as the hopping increases, it melts it and gives a superfluid state. Here, Monte Carlo can reveal some qualitatively new physics about the pseudo-gap state. Marching on in complexity, we come to the positive U-Hubbard model. In this case, we have a good idea about the behavior at large U, where we know the ground state is a quantum antiferromagnet, and this is well understood. Once you turn on, remove some of these spins and put holes in, then the situation is less clear. There are multiple mean field theories. Dynamical mean field theory has been quite successful recently, and Matthias will talk about DMRG on these kinds of models. Standard quantum Monte Carlo in these in this category is somewhat difficult because of the sign problem and limited really to high temperatures. So whereas these two Monte Carlos that I will talk about are exact in the sense they are, you basically get results that are not corrupted by any systematic errors, only statistical errors. In this case, the results are more approximate, and I will nevertheless show you some quite a bit of progress that we have been able to make using a variational ansatz for the ground state. So that's sort of the broad picture. And what I will do is just hit a few highlights in the three categories. So just to step back and ask, what are some of the big questions we want to understand? We've seen these pictures from Emmanuel Bloch's group on bosons in an optical lattice, where they see the coherence disappear as the tunneling is reduced. And this is data from Wolfgang Ketterle's group on attractive fermions, again in an optical lattice, with increasing tunneling. With decreasing tunneling. And again, you see the sharp features become more fuzzy. And one of the questions we would like to understand is, what is the contribution of quantum fluctuations, which increases as you go to smaller and smaller tunneling, and the effect of thermal fluctuations in producing these so-called fuzzy pictures? Another big question would be, in the positive U-Hubbard model, this question is still open, whether the ground state has a superfluid phase or not. So, of course, this question has been asked in the high TC context, but what is nice about the cube rates is that in the there are some big question marks in going from the actual material to modeling it in terms of Hubbard models in the in a real material. And in the cold atoms, that uncertainty goes away because hopefully we will get specially designed Hubbard lattices that we want. So the question now becomes, in the positive U-Hubbard model, is there a superfluid phase or not? And the third other big question is, we have seen in these unequal populations that there might be indications of a pseudo-gap phase at zero temperature. Is there such a possibility or not? Today I will address these two in much more detail, and this is some things we are working on. Okay, so the Bose-Hubbard model. I want to give you a little flavor of what goes behind this word Monte Carlo, because it seems like, you know, it's one black box that people seem to take out at various times. And I want to give you a very quick flavor of what is involved in these different Monte Carlos. So here, essentially, the aim of all of these simulations is to somehow simulate the partition function exactly. That's what one would like to do. And once you have the partition function, you can calculate any of the properties in equilibrium. Now, for bosons, you can write down the partition function essentially as a propagator in imaginary time. So beta, which is the inverse temperature, is a time axis here. This is d-dimensional space. And each of these bosons essentially carve out some trajectory in space-time. Now, you can imagine for any number of bosons, you would have a huge number of configurations, all of these different spaghetti configurations. And this is where you use Monte Carlo to sample that configuration space. And by sample, what I mean is it's a very powerful technique which allows you in a big mess to somehow find a needle in a haystack. That's the idea behind the Monte Carlo sampling. And essentially, out of all these spaghetti configurations, you try to find those configurations that have the largest weight as dictated by e to the minus beta h. Now, it turns out for bosons, this can be done essentially exactly with only statistical errors. Okay, so we have some recent simulations on the 3D Bose-Hubbard model. That's the model here. There's the tunneling amplitude and the on-site interaction. And what you see is, this is on the y-axis, I have three quantities, the density, the superfluid density, and the condensate fraction as a function of tunneling. So you can see when the tunneling is large, you are essentially in the superfluid phase, where rho s, the superfluid density, is basically close to rho. And as you reduce the tunneling, the superfluid density decreases and vanishes at some critical tunneling T over U of around 0.2. And then the system enters a phase where the density is fixed at 1, and that's the Mott phase. N0, so rho s would be something that would be measured in a rotation experiment where you would see some of the liquid not rotating with the wall because of loss of friction, it will disengage from the rotation. That's how rho s would be measured. N0 is the condensate fraction, or 1 minus N0 is the depletion, which has been measured in some of the experiments. And you can see it is typically less than rho s because it's just counting how many bosons are in the lowest eigenstate. But that too disappears at the same critical point. Yeah. At very, very weak interactions, all the bosons, would condense into the lowest eigenstate. So rho s would become rho, and N0 would also approach rho. At very, very, that would be somewhere way off scale. This is already quite a correlated superfluid, which itself has some interesting properties. Okay, now this order parameter has been measured by Esslinger's group, not quite in an optical lattice yet, but in a trapped Bose gas, and I just want to show that this is just the order parameter correlation at a distance r away, and you can see when the temperature is low, this correlation goes to a constant, which signals the emergence of off-diagonal long-range order or superfluidity, and when the temperature is increased, the ordering goes away. So this is something we can calculate, the order parameter correlations, and here I'm showing you the results for a tunneling T over U at 0.25. Remember, the critical point is at 0.2, so you can see at low temperatures, you get a superfluid phase, which is then killed by thermal fluctuations. You can also do another kind of probe where you sit at low temperatures at 0.1 and tune the tunneling. So this is the tuning the quantum parameter, T over U, and you can see when the tunneling is large, you have a superfluid, and then at some critical T over U of 0.2, the order goes away. So in this case, it's suppressed by quantum fluctuations. Okay, so we can now look at the momentum distribution, which is just the Fourier transform of the order parameter correlations. And you can see that in the superfluid phase, there is a lot of weight. This point here is k equal to 0. There's a huge buildup of weight at k equal to 0, and it rapidly decays everywhere for all other k's. This is a signature of a superfluid phase. As we reduce the tunneling, this is very, very close to the transition. The transition is at 0.195. At 0.2, you can still see the signature of a superfluid peak, which is very large. This height here is 180 for the system, and it's extremely peaked at k equal to 0. When we cross the transition and go to the Mott phase, now you have n of k, which has weight at many wave vectors. And if I take a cut through this, you get a behavior like this. N of k essentially decays as a function of k, and it's essentially of order 1 or order 10 or whatever at all the sites. It's not peaked like this of order n. So we can look at this a little more closely now in the Mott phase. If I just sit at very low temperatures and reduce the tunneling going along this axis, you can see that in the extreme Mott limit, N of k would basically have become homogeneous. I mean, would have equal amplitude at all the k points because it's localized in density, and you would get something like this. And as you approach the Mott phase, so 0.1875, this one is close to the transition. You can see it has, it's still quite peaked. And as I go toward the red curve, you can see it's getting flatter and more like this extreme limit. It's tending toward that. So these are the. So we also have similar results as a function of temperature, and we need to analyze these a little bit more in view of the discussion we had the other day between Jason and Emmanuel Bloch's experiments. We have to convolve these with some trap in order to get an idea of how the visibility is changing in these regimes. And what is the role being played by quantum fluctuations versus the thermal fluctuations? Okay, so as we heard in some of the earlier talks, one of the problems in these interacting optical lattices is a problem of determining the temperature. because these are interacting systems, and you can't assume that the expansion is ballistic and thereby try to recreate what the momentum distribution was in the beginning. So what would be useful in this in such a situation is to have maybe some detailed data from the numerics where one might have the behavior of the entropy as a function of temperature and this tuning, the tunneling, T over U, and use this in conjunction with the experiments to maybe try to determine the temperature. So this is an attempt to do something like that. For this 3D model, we have, here I'm showing the energy as a function of temperature. This is the superfluid data going toward the MOT. And we can take this energy simulation results and from that extract the entropy. First, we can get the specific heat, and you can see this nice jump at the transition in the superfluid, which becomes quite broad in the MOT state. And you can C over T and integrate that to get the entropy. And now we can say something, we can explore this behavior a little bit in detail in terms of how the experiments are done. So typically in the experiments, you would start with a large hopping so that one is in a superfluid phase. And that would be, let's say we can fix something like that here. So this red curve is for the superfluid system. This, and then these successive ones are going into the MOT phase. So the idea is that what is done in the experiment is when the tunneling is large, you can essentially determine in that phase what the temperature is and what the entropy is. And then essentially the lowering or raising of the lattice is done under adiabatic conditions. So the question is, how does the temperature evolve during some such scan? Okay, so what the simulations essentially reveal is that if I sat at some entropy, let's say of 0.1 in the superfluid phase, and then cranked up the lattice potential and went toward the MOT phase, my temperature would successively increase. And that is shown here. This is the temperature for a typical adiabatic scan. You can see in the superfluid phase, the temperature is basically reducing a little bit. That's a little cooling effect so long as you're in the superfluid. When you come close to the transition, the effective temperature is starting to rise in order to keep the same entropy. Okay, and that's not surprising. That's along the lines of what Jason was also saying. In the MOT phase, you have a gap. So if you want to keep the same entropy as the superfluid, you have to be at a much higher temperature to generate enough excitations to get the same entropy. That's the reason for this rise. Now, what we need to do next is to see whether these temperatures and so on, how do these affect quantitatively some of these visibility peaks, and whether what can we say now about some of the N of momentum distributions that have been produced. Okay, so much on the Bose-Hubbard model. Coming now to the fermion model with attraction. Here we have to use a different technique because we are dealing with fermionic variables. So we turn to a coherent state path integral. And the essential idea of this method is the difficult term in the Hamiltonian comes from the interactions. And the interactions are essentially quartic in the fermionic operators. So you want to somehow convert them into a quadratic form. And that is done by introducing some auxiliary variables, Si tau, which sit at each point in space-time. So here is a space-time map, and at each point, I have one of these Ising variables. And using these Ising variables now, one can then essentially integrate out the fermions, and that same partition function can be written down as two determinants for up and down fermions. Now again, one would get typically many, many configurations, an infinitely large number of configurations of these Ising variables. And this is again where Monte Carlo is called upon to figure out which configurations to really choose and how to organize the space. So this has a close relationship to mean field theories and fluctuations, where if you assume these variables are constant, then you get a mean field theory. You can expand around saddle points and so on and get fluctuation physics out. But in our case, we sample that exactly. So there's no assumption made. And we can it's important to say that here is a fermion model, which for at least equal number of fermions, we can get Monte Carlo results, which are exact. So that's kind of rare to find. Okay, so again, there are many aspects of this problem one can look at, but I want to focus on just one question right now, which is, there's a lot been said about the BCS-BEC crossover at low temperatures. I want to focus on issues at finite temperatures and ask, how do the properties of the system evolve from a normal Fermi liquid to a Bose liquid without really crossing a transition? Okay, so that's the focus of my question. So here is the temperature. Here is, let's say, the lattice potential, which is being... you can think of this axis here as an attraction. The U in the Hubbard model is being increased, or the hopping is being decreased. And so you see that when you're in this limit here, you have a BCS-like situation with a normal state, which is a Fermi liquid. And a Fermi liquid has certain characteristics in terms of its response function. On the other hand, if you crank up the attraction, you get small, tightly bound molecules, and its normal state is a Bose liquid. And we would like to understand this crossover here. Now, we don't want to go in the completely non-degenerate regime, because that's not interesting. We still want to be in a regime where quantum effects are important. So this is a plot of the chemical potential and temperature, and you can basically see that if you're at low enough temperature and certain values of... As you crank up the attraction, this U is the attraction, you're going to finally become non-degenerate. So you want to stay within this curve here to be in a regime where the system is fairly degenerate. So let me pick some point here at U equal to 4 in units of the hopping and some temperature around this point here. And let's just look at the properties there. If you look at the momentum distribution, it looks rather boring. Okay, it basically looks like a slightly broadened Fermi distribution. The dotted curve here is just the thermally broadened Fermi distribution, and the dots here are the results from the simulations telling us what N of K is doing and how it is broadened due to some attraction. But even when the system looks very fermionic and very, sort of garden variety broadened Fermi surface, its response functions are quite different. And this was first pointed out in our paper in 92, where we produced the first evidence of what happens in that so-called pseudo-gap region, which is a region, let me just point out here. Oh, shoot. Okay, which is a region here. I want to sit in this region above TC, but below another temperature scale T star, where you get pairing physics. And what we find is that in that region, two quantities, the spin fluctuations and the charge fluctuations, which are essentially equal in the Fermi liquid. So in a Fermi liquid, if I tried to look at the spin susceptibility, that would just go like the density of states, and the compressibility would also go like the density of states. Both would be equal and independent of temperature. However, in the pseudo-gap region, you see that the spin susceptibility is dropping down rapidly because you're getting pairing, and these pairs are not going to contribute to, basically going out of the response, and the susceptibility drops rapidly, whereas the compressibility is more or less temperature independent. So that's one characteristic. The other thing, as the name implies, pseudo-gap, when you're below TC, there's, of course, a full gap in the spectrum. When you come above TC, if it was just aluminum or some other garden variety BCS superconductor, there would be no gap. But in the pseudo gap region, if you measure the low energy density of states shown here as these solid points, they are also strongly temperature dependent and suppressed from what it would be in the normal state. So there's an opening of the low, and there's a opening of a gap in the density of states and the spin spectrum. Okay, now more in context of the cold atom experiments, in these experiments, one is while the compressibility can be measured in some of the experiments, I'm not sure the susceptibility is being directly probed. But they are able to probe density and spin-related correlations. So they are you can connect these response functions to these up-up plus up-down density correlations and up-up minus up-down, which probes the spin channel. And these could be hopefully measured in these experiments. We also have some results for how the number of doubly occupied sites changes with U and temperature. And these are nothing very unusual in the behavior, but these could again be used for thermometry to identify what temperature you might be at. Similarly, the momentum distribution function at k equal to zero, that point deep inside the Fermi surface, changes with U and temperature. And that might be another way to identify the temperature effects. These are very recent data on the specific heat. Again, we would like to do the same thing that we did in the bosonic problem, get the entropy and do adiabatic scans. And this is very recent data showing that we are able to extract the specific heat as a function of temperature. It shows these two bumps, one showing behavior at T star, where you start getting pairing physics, and another sharper feature where you get coherence. Okay, so that's where we are on the attractive U-Hubbard model. I'm now going to move to the third part on the repulsive U-Hubbard model. This is the most challenging Hamiltonian that we have looked at. Here we have, I've just sketched some kind of a phase diagram. This is essentially hopping over U, and this is doping. We know when the doping is zero on a square lattice, you basically have a Mott insulator with antiferromagnetic long-range order, and it goes over into a spin density wave insulator. But it's insulating along this axis. As you put in holes, at some point, at very large hole density, you then get a Fermi liquid, and the question is, what is happening in the middle? Now, we don't have, since we can't do exact simulations here, we can't make any precise statements, but we can motivate why you might see superfluidity in that regime. So let me try to do that. So let me start with the repulsive Fermion-Hubbard model, which has some Hamiltonian like this. This is the band structure part. This is the positive U repulsion. The band structure part contains the energy scale T, the hopping. And the first thing you need to do is to suppress the charge fluctuations. That's one ingredient you need to do to get towards superfluidity, is suppress the charge fluctuations, and that then brings out the spin physics. It brings out this lower energy scale J, which goes like T square over U. So once the spin physics emerges, the effective Hamiltonian becomes like an antiferromagnetic exchange between the spins. And there's additional term for the hopping, which I'm not showing. But this is the essential spin Hamiltonian that emerges at low energies. Now one can rewrite, this is a new operator, a singlet bond operator, which essentially creates a singlet on sites R and R prime. And in terms of the bond operator, this Hamiltonian can be exactly transformed into what is shown here. So from F dot S, you can go to B dagger B with a minus sign. So you can essentially see that you started out with a repulsive model, and by going into a singlet basis, it has generated attraction. And this attraction, if you look at it in K space, is in a D-wave channel, and the scale for the D-wave pairing, from here you can basically do mean field theory and see D-wave superconductivity or superfluidity emerge. The scale for that is just set by J. Now, at x equal to 0, where you have no holes, one can do fairly accurate simulations, and that was done by Scalapino and collaborators, and they showed that you get this. This is the spin-spin correlation function as a function of R. It has this nice antiferromagnetic oscillation. At some finite temperature, at zero temperature also, in a square lattice, antiferromagnetism survives, though the net moment at a site is reduced by 60% or so. But the more interesting question is, what happens when you dope it, and what happens when you dope the system? What emerges? Okay, I think I have to run a little faster. Let me skip this. So essentially what I'm going to discuss is the other properties of the superconducting phase there. And this is going to be done within a variational approach using RVB states. So let me just motivate that quickly. For two sites, this just shows a singlet bond. And with four sites, you can essentially, for such a configuration, pair them up in this way or this way, and the system resonates between both of these. So just this by itself is a valence bond configuration. It's a static solid configuration, and now it's fluctuating between these. It's called a resonating valence bond. You can write this very nicely as a determinant, and that keeps track of all the signs. So basically for two sites, you can write down an RVB wave function in this form. For many sites, you can construct a similar determinant which pairs up and down fermions. And this determinant here essentially is an exact representation of the BCS wave function in a fixed number basis. So this determinant is exactly what you would write the more familiar grand canonical form of the wave function in if you were to choose a fixed number basis. Now, what is done in the RVB state, though, is you do not want any of these sites to be doubly occupied, because we are dealing with a problem in which the correlations are very strong. So you want to remove certain states from the Hilbert space, and that is done using a projection operator. So this is a picture. This is the picture you should carry with you for what the superfluid ground state probably looks like. It has these singlet bonds between different sites, and these bonds have lengths which are not just restricted to nearest neighbor but could be arbitrarily long, and that depends on the kind of pairing states you use. Okay, so let me just give you one or two key results that emerge. The first thing that emerges is that you get very different behavior for the energy gap and the order parameter. In a BCS theory, the two would have been identical. But here what you find is that the energy gap, as a function of doping, increases as you go toward lower doping and you reach half filling. The pairing gap is still finite. On the other hand, the order parameter, which is obtained by looking at long-range pairing correlations, has this dome-shaped behavior sort of mimicking TC, and this mimics T star. So this is a signature of a strongly correlated superconductor, that you have a separation between the pairing and coherent scales. Yes, energy scale is exchanged. I should be put, I have to multiply this by J. What I have shown here is not quite the energy scale. This is just delta here is actually obtained by taking that wave function which I showed you, putting a quasi-particle in that, you know, by removing one particle and then finding the energy of that. So that is the gap energy which is shown here, and the energy scale for that is J. Okay, this is the order parameter. Okay, now the other key quantity to look at in the context of these cold atoms We heard a beautiful talk by Christoph Salomon, and they are gearing up to measure the spectral function of the fermions. And that's a very key quantity, and I want to share some of the results we have on that. So here is A of K and omega, which is basically depicting the behavior of the Green's function, the fermion Green's function. Now, typically, A of K and omega has this behavior. It has a sharp piece, which is called the quasiparticle, and its weight will, in an interacting system, will be less than 1, because the total weight is conserved. The rest of the weight goes into incoherent multiparticle scattering. And the question we would like to ask, this is a strongly interacting system, how is the spectral weight organized? So what we find is, unlike a BCS superconductor where the spectral weight would have been 1, we find the spectral weight Z. So you can go along one of these axes and look at the discontinuity in the momentum distribution, and from that you can get the quasi-particle weight Z and look at how it behaves as a function of doping, and you find that as you go toward the insulator, the quasi-particle weight is dropping. So it's telling you that most of the fermions or quasi-particles that you make are getting strongly scattered into multi-particle excitations. I think I need to... No time left? Okay. minus 1, just... May I beg you for just a bit? Okay. Let me... I have to skip some nice stuff. Okay, never mind. So let me... one more thing about that. So the key issues for the cold atoms would be to basically look at K-dependent quantities. If you come to the positive U-Hubbard model, the K-dependence is very interesting for the gap and for the nature of the coherence. And I've shown what the quasi-particle weight does. There are also many surprises in the velocity of these quasi-particles, and all of these can be investigated. So let me just put up this last slide. Instead of a conclusion, we are sort of on the next set of things we need to do is to nail some of the issues of thermometry in the Bose-Hubbard model, and in the fermion-Hubbard model, look for some of these unusual normal states. So let me just end with that. Thank you.
We have time for a few questions.
You had one of your major questions that was driving the science to see if you had, in the attractive Hubbard model, a pseudo gap at zero temperature, albeit an unpolarized case. And do you have any insight?
So it was not so much in the attractive. So in the attractive case, we are right now looking at unequal polarizations to drive the pseudo gap to zero temperatures. In the positive view, we can even address it at the level of the equal fermion populations in the positive UK.
So the question was, just tell me what it was again that was your major question, because then maybe
the question was essentially whether the pseudo-gap phase, which we are seeing at finite temperature, let's say you bring in another axis, another like polarization, and you now drive the pseudo-gap scale to zero, do you have that phase existing at zero temperature?
Right. Okay.
But even at equal filling, you can address that in the positive U case, positive U Hubbard model, because when superconductivity is suppressed, what is the phase that you go into? In the present wave function that we have looked at, you just go into a Mott insulator. But there could be the possibility of other phases when you drive TC down. And that can also be investigated by looking at other general wave functions, yeah.
Okay.
Do we have other questions? If not, then let us thank the speaker one more time.